You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you on February the 19th, 2026, in a week when the wings Remco Evenepoel seems to have sprouted since moving to Red Bull, were clipped in the UAE. And speaking of bulls, Del Toro hinted that he and not Remco or Vingegaard could be the most credible threat to Tadej Pogacar in 2026. My name is Daniel Freeburn. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll try not to speak too much bull as we recap the most recent developments in the world of professional cycling. Here to assist me in that endeavour today is none other than the Motown Maestro. Who else on the day when Smokey Robinson, the other Motown Maestro, Larry, turns 86? Happy birthday, Smokey, if you're listening. And welcome, Larry. Larry's sitting in a beautiful, gorgeous, bathed in sunlight outside his gaff, his palatial gaff in Ez. We won't give the exact address, but on the Côte d'Azur. And you've told me it's, what is it, 17 degrees,
Larry? I mean, probably. I mean, in the sun right now, it's probably more than 20 because, like, I'm almost sweating in a t-shirt. So pretty nice weather here. We're pretty lucky.
Springtime weather. We've just been discussing your springtime plans, Larry, or your commitments, shall we say. After, were you doing a race this weekend? Tell the listeners which race you're doing.
This weekend I'm doing... now it's called Tour de Var and Alpes Maritimes, so it's 2 1-days down here in the south of France. Then I'll do La Guelia after that, and then after that it's TBD, so we'll see what happens in the next weeks.
TBD, what's that the tour of? Tour? Or is that to be defined?
Not sure.
there are so many races changing their names at the moment. Dauphiné, Paris-Roubaix. I'm not going to say what they should be called now because we're gonna completely ignore the official denominations and continue to call them what they've always been called. Larry, that's the future. Let's kick off, shall we? Talking a little bit about the recent past. You have been in action already. You were in Oman. When was that? Last week? There's been so much racing in the meantime that it seems like a long time ago. But how did it go for you? That was your season's debut.
Yeah, I actually did one day in Mallorca. So I was sick in Mallorca, so I only ended up doing one of the days there and was just stuck in a hotel for a few days before. So that wasn't ideal. And then, went to Oman. It was a nice race. Unfortunately, we didn't really get the results we were hoping for, but it's a really pleasant race to do. It's like, I don't know, it's not too stressful. The weather's great. It's hard enough, but not too hard. So, races like UAE, there's a lot of stress, but then a lot of the day you're just coasting. A lot of people stress because, like, they're worried about losing fitness, and then the food's good in the hotel, so then you're like, can't eat too much because, like, we're not riding very hard, but you still have the stress of the race and then stress of potential crosswinds. So Oman, there's not a crazy amount of wind, and it's pretty mountainous, so there's a lot more elevation gain, which means, like, you're more on the pedals during the race. And so, yeah, it was a nice week, even without any crazy results for us. But it was nice way to sort of get back into the race rhythm. And I think I'm ready for the next races.
Larry, we've had many conversations over the last couple of years about things getting faster and faster. And I've had a few conversations with riders over the last 2 or 3 weeks who were about to begin their seasons. And the sense you sort of get is of a kind of everyone sort of being suspended, dangling above a saucepan of hot oil, and they're about to get dropped in, and they just don't know. They're sort of braced for it to be even worse, even faster, even more intense than it was the previous year. Does that sound familiar to you? Did you feel a bit like that before your first race?
Yeah, definitely. But I don't think it has anything to do with necessarily, like, the increasing speeds and all this kind of stuff. I think it's more just like, every year... It's like going back to school, you're nervous. You don't really know how it's going to go. It's like, you trained hard, your numbers are where they need to be, everything's been going, in the right direction, but then it's still not racing, training isn't racing. And so until you're in the peloton and able to sort of see how you are relative to everyone else, you are a bit apprehensive. So I think that's a normal feeling. And I definitely felt it before the first races. I was like a bit nervous and stressed, but in the end you start and it's just like every other year. So
You're lovely and serene now. Larry, we're going to talk a lot about the racing that we have seen later in the episode. We're also going to talk a bit about off the bike matters, but we'll kick off just in this first part. I'll give you multiple choice. You can either have Pogge's power data or the UCI's call to action yesterday, I think it was, or was it the day before, when the UCI president, David Lapartien, announced that there will be this consultation in which you too, Larry, will be involved as one of the sports stakeholders, basically asking what professional cycling should be in the future. But anyway, which one would you like to... We're going to spend 2 or 3 minutes just talking about one of these issues. Would you prefer Pogge's power data or the future of
cycling? Sure, we could do Pogge's power data because for some reason I didn't receive this email. So it must have been in my spam because I was riding with Matteo Jorgensen the other day and he was like, oh yeah, did you get that email from like the UCI? I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then I checked my email when I got home and I didn't have the email. So unless it maybe went into my spam or trash or whatever, but...
Well, if it was a few days ago, it was a few days before the general public found out about this. And maybe Matteo got a leak.
Maybe he's hacked into the system.
Anyway, we might revisit that theme because I think it's an interesting theme. But I thought you were the ideal man to give us a learned perspective on one of the sort of interesting tidbits that have come out over the last couple of weeks. And this was Tadej Pogačar. I mean, the most eye-catching thing initially was that he was using a ride and using an entry on Strava to appeal to fans to behave with a little bit more decorum when they see pro riders out in the wild. But also, secondary to that, was the fact that he took the rare step, and it is rare for him, of publishing his power data. First thing, I suppose, to ask you, first thing to establish, is why do you think, well, initially, why does he not do this more often? And why did he choose this occasion to do it?
Yeah, so I would assume that now UAE doesn't allow their riders to publish power data. And then I would assume with Tadej, that probably has been going on, you know, quite a bit longer. You know, I think like it probably comes more from the team than it even does from him. They just don't want him to share like his training so that other people could see his workouts or, you know, perhaps his weaknesses and things like that. So I know, you know, there were quite a few guys on UAE who shared all their data, all their training, all their power from training and races over the last years, like Brandon McNulty and Pavel Sivakov, among others. But then this year they took the power data off, both of them. So I'm assuming that came from the team. So, you know, I'd say the team probably said they were no longer allowed to do that. And I get that because, you know, it's like if these coaches are developing, you know, proprietary workouts and things like that, they don't really want to like share them with other teams and things like that. Or even perhaps, you know, those guys are both big riders. They're not exactly Pogačar, but, you know, it would give other teams perhaps less to analyze. You know, I guess the less data they have, the less, you know, sort of weaknesses they can find in how to crack them. So I would say the other day was probably more just like, maybe he thought, okay, you know, I'm going to write this note about, you know, so I guess the for people who didn't see, it was some fan, you know, asked him for a photo, but he was in the middle of talking to someone or doing something. And then he said, oh, could you just wait 2 minutes? You know, and, you know, I think he would have then given, you know, taken a photo with him or whatever. And then the people like gave him the middle finger and I don't know if they said whatever. And then they were going on and on, this guy and his wife. So he just said, you know, please, you know, have some respect. You know, and I do really feel that like Tadej really gives a lot of time for the public and, you know, he's really generous in terms of like taking photos, things like that, being really friendly with people on the road. So,
And without being glib as well, Larry, I mean, maybe you don't get harassed and besieged to the same extent as Tadej Pogačar, but people see you in pro kit and they probably recognize you in some cases. They see you on a pro bike and this probably happens to you as well. People want to ride in your wheel or they want to talk to you when you don't necessarily in that particular moment want to engage.
Yeah, I mean, that's super annoying sometimes in that like it happens to, every pro I know and even some non-pros is like, you know, sometimes people just follow you and then like, you know, I don't know. It's like they don't ask or they don't say anything. And then they just like follow you wherever you go. And then, you know, I don't know, one time someone was following me. And so then I was like, okay, I just wanted to ride by myself. I wanted to ride easy. And so then I just turned and then they followed me down the turn. Then I turned again in a different way. And then they followed me again. Then I just fully did a U-turn and then they followed me again. And then I just stopped to pee and I told them like, okay, you know, you can go now, you know, like, just because I don't know, sometimes it's a bit awkward or, you know, if you're riding with someone else, you know, like the thing is if people ask, hey, do you mind if we sit on or follow or whatever, then almost every time, you know, the pros will say, yeah, sure. No problem. You know? But it's just awkward when people don't ask and then, you know, they're just sitting on and perhaps if you're riding with someone, you're having a personal conversation. It's like, you can't really then keep talking because you have someone just following you and listening to what you're saying. So, it's just a bit annoying, but I don't think this was even the case there. I think this was like, he was stopped. So it's just a bit, yeah, it's too bad that people, you know, assume it's their right to, essentially, yeah, have, a photo with Tade or whatever, you know? So, but yeah, beyond that, why he shared his power data, I don't know. It was maybe just, maybe he just thought like, well, if I'm going to write this, I'm going to just be open about like the day and whatever, you know? So I'm just going
to. Maybe it was a warning to anyone, any amateur who thought that they might be able to.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, maybe.
And stalk him that way.
But I guess like then going on about the power is that, I mean, it was not a really anything special file, which this is the thing is everyone's going on, oh my gosh, like what can we read into from this? But really there was not much to read into. I mean, he just did an endurance ride and like, yeah, he's strong. He just did zone two, but you know, he already has said in interviews what his zone two is. And so yeah, it was just a zone two ride where he was like sitting on the pedals, you know, averaged like 300 watts for maybe 3 hours, which, okay, that's a little bit different than some guys because most guys don't usually just sit there for 3 hours. Maybe they'll do blocks, things like that. The only more interesting thing is though, is because then his zones also came up from the ride. You could see his zones.
Yeah, set by Strava, yeah. determined by Strava.
But then the thing is by that is like, who knows how recently he updated his threshold, you know? So I think according to the threshold written in Strava, it was like 430 watts. That's interesting.
388, the zone four threshold, 388 to 442.
Right, right. So I think that set is like FTP or, you know, like yeah, aerobic anaerobic threshold at like 430 watts, which is probably in the ballpark. I would say it's somewhere between 430 and 450. But you know, again, that was maybe the only interesting thing. Beyond that, I don't think it was anything too crazy. But it's just funny because then that made this whole thing go kind of viral because he shared his power. But I think there's a lot more interesting power data that other guys share, you know, in the Peloton, like namely his teammates from last year and stuff. But yeah, so it was interesting, but I wouldn't say it was anything crazy.
Based on what I've heard and read, Larry, broadly aligned with what he said in an interview with the, well, now
disgraced
Peter Attia, who was dishonorably mentioned 1,700 times in the Epstein files or in those that have been published to date. But broadly it aligned with that, and there was nothing that wasn't necessarily aligned with what we've seen on the road from Tadej Pogacar.
For sure.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel anytime. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, Larry, that's Pog's Power dealt with. We are going to move on now to talk about some racing that has been happening over the last few days of racing, not featuring you, Larry, because as we heard, you were in action in Oman and now you're preparing for your next races. But Larry, this is one of the most packed periods of the season, and actually, well, I offered you a choice in the first part whether to talk about Pogacar's Power or the state of the sport and this UCI consultation that's going to take place. We don't know exactly how it's going to take place, but it's going to take place over the coming months, and basically everyone sort of suggesting what they think should happen with professional cycling. And Larry, I've been watching, been following all of the races this week, and a combination of that, so races, for example, Ruta del Sol is happening at the moment, first stage yesterday, one of the most exciting, probably passages of racing that we're going to see at the Ruta del Sol this week, because it's not the most, well, it's not the most mountainous route. It sort of happened midway through yesterday's stage. There was sort of flurry of attacks, the likes of Pidcock were involved. And this is a sort of a weekday afternoon, middle of the afternoon on a Wednesday, and it sort of made me think about connect a few other things that have been going on. So the UCI basically asking everyone to tell them what they think cycling should be. I read an interview the other day with Jonathan Vaughters, I think it was with Daniel Benson, our colleague, talking about how his team's not interested in points at all. They're basically interested in the sort of stories that their riders tell. Then we've got Visma, who have been reported by our colleagues at Vila Flits to be looking for a new sponsor, and we've heard in recent weeks about their financial problems in general as a team. Well, problems is maybe too strong a word, but certainly they need money. We know that. And so there were a few things, and it just sort of struck me that this sport has just been on the psychoanalyst couch for so long and continues to be on the psychoanalyst couch. And that is essentially the question that the UCI are asking with this consultation. What is this sport? What is this sport? What's it supposed to be? What do people want from it? And we never seem to advance, get any further. Certainly in finding a strong consensus about the direction to go in, because I think those quotes, what I just said from Jonathan Vaughter, sort of underlines that really. His team and his agenda seems to be completely different from others, in inverted commas, stakeholders.
Oh, I mean, yeah, he says that, but I can tell you if they're near the relegation zone, they care about points, you know? Unfortunately, it's just something every team cares about at the moment is points, 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 points. So, but beyond that, yeah, I don't know what the answer is. You know, I would say one of the reasons I believe that we're like sort of stuck as a sport and not like, you know, advancing or progressing is because it's quite disjointed. And because the sport's so international and takes place so globally, it's hard to get everyone on the same page, you know? So, you know, ASO has their own interests, RCS has their own interests, you know, every little race organizer around the globe has their own interests. And I would say the fact that we aren't all under the same umbrella and, you know, every team is sort of like its separate entity. Yes, okay, the UCI is sort of like on top, but like Do they really have the most power? I don't know. You know, I'd say like ASO probably has more power than they do. And so I'd say it's hard to get all these different parties on the same page. And, you know, unless the UCI sort of tells the ASO how it's going to be, which is probably not going to happen, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of progression or anything evolve from here. So, you know, I just think, you know, it's like if you look at a lot of other big sports, is, you know, everything's totally controlled by like the governing body. And, you know, it's just not that way in cycling. And I think that is sort of to our detriment because, yeah, there's too many competing interests. And yeah, I think it's hard to get everyone on the same page because everyone has different interests.
To be in it. I mean, those quotes, those comments from Voters underline that. I mean, even among the 18 World Tour teams, there are very different agendas there, aren't there? Very different things that they want to achieve. Well, the sponsors want to achieve, and sponsors, we know that's the primary revenue stream. Some of those sponsors are in it for one reason, and others are in it for completely different reasons. I'm fairly pessimistic about this consultation. It won't be the first attempt, certainly won't be the first attempt to get everyone aligned, and none have so far, as we said, seem to advance us too much. Larry, as I said, an awful lot of stage races going on at the moment. We mentioned Oman. Let's recap a couple that happened at the weekend. First of all, Murcia should have been a two-day race. It was only one day in the end. And on that one day, Marc Soler won ahead of his teammate, Julius Johansson. Initially, it seemed, with the cancellation of the second stage due to inclement weather, that Marc Soler would also be awarded the GC. Points for the GC. That has not happened now. They've effectively been taken away, those points, and the honour as well of being the winner of that race. So that was a bit of a non-event, unfortunately. We also had the Tour de la Provence, first stage won by Arnaud Tondon of Van Rysel, who are having a fantastic start to the season, Continental Division team. And then things got interesting at the weekend with Matthew Riccitello winning on the Montagne de Lure and Axel Laurens winning for Ineos on the final day. That gave Riccitello overall victory. And Larry, it struck me that he's probably a rider you know pretty well. He's obviously moved teams this year to Decathlon. A rider who's been sort of touted as a big talent for a long time and is really sort of delivering on that promise now.
Yeah, I mean, pretty cool to see because, you know, I know the thing is when he was under 23, he was supposed to be this big talent. You know, I think he was even junior under 23 national TT champion, and he weighs like 60 kilos or maybe 50 something kilos, you know, probably lower 50 kilos. And so, you know, he was supposed to be this great climber. And then I think so he turned pro with Israel at the time, on quite a big contract from what I heard. Yeah, then maybe that first year he did Tour de l'Avenir and he was in the yellow jersey going into the last day and was only sort of cracked by Isaac Del Toro at the end. But on a few days he had beat Del Toro. So, you know, obviously we've seen what Del Toro has done in the last year or two. And so it's nice to see that Matthew is sort of coming into his own and also producing those results. So, you know, I think last year what he did in the Vuelta was pretty unexpected to almost everyone, including I think even himself. Like I rode with him a few days, maybe a week before the Vuelta last year, and he wasn't even supposed to be doing the Vuelta. So it was only like after that there was like a change of something in the team. And they ended up being like, okay, fine. Yeah, you do the Vuelta. Because they knew he was leaving the team. So then he goes to the Vuelta, gets fifth overall,
wins the white jersey.
I think that was the first time also, yes. So, yeah, you know, I think especially being on that team, in such a politically charged race. I think that was very impressive that he was able to keep his head through that whole thing. And so then it's cool to see now that he transferred to this new team and boom, straight away delivers, you know, with a nice result, especially for them, you know, in a French race, not too far off from where their sponsor, CMAC GM, is based. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, I was really happy to see that, and hopefully it's the beginning of more big things to come from him.
Mm. Larry, I also wanted to talk to you about another American rider in that race in the Tour de la Provence, and that's AJ August, the Ineos Grenadiers rider. And I've been thinking about him over the last few days because, well, A, he's had a brilliant start to the season. He won a stage in Valencia, and he was outstanding. He was riding for Carlos Rodriguez on the big mountain stage to the Montagne du Lourdes. Now, this is a rider, he's 20 years old, just turned 20 in October, and this is a rider who's been, again, touted as a huge talent, similar to Ricky Taylor, even more so than Ricky Taylor. And he's one of these riders, Larry, about whom a statement was made 2 or 3 years ago by someone who knew him well, which I sort of feared at the time, and I've sort of regretted since, that this will hang over him, this statement. And it was his hot tubes
team manager
Toby Stanton, who said, I mean, I'll just read the quote. He went to an Ineos, this is a couple of years ago, he went to an Ineos training camp in Mallorca this January and did some testing on him. His VO2 max was 92. They said they didn't have anyone that could do what he could do. He's Remco, but with probably more with more power. So you remember it, though. You haven't got it from me. You remember it. And, well, you just talked about Decathlon there. Now, Larry, every week I listen to the RMC French podcast, and it's pretty much become the Sexas cast. Every week they talk about Paul Sexas. And we've talked already on the podcast about whether this makes us a little bit sort of queasy, a bit nervous, all the hype around Paul Sexas. But, you know, I've often thought about this quote regarding AJ August, and sort of worried that it can, just one single soundbite like that, it can set the narrative for a young person, a young rider, a young sports person's career. And it can become a bit of a bar, a yardstick by which they are measured, and it can be used to beat them as well when things don't go well. And AJ August, he turned professional so quickly. He's a bit of a victim of this arms race to get the youngest talent available. And Ineos probably signed him mainly because they were worried that other people were going to get there first. And they did that with Michael Leonard as well. And they sort of fast-tracked them into the World Tour teams. They didn't have development teams. And I think it's been quite a rough ride, particularly for those two guys. Leonard's now left for EF Education First. AJ August, fortunately, seems to be finding his feet. And the talent does seem to be shining through. But I just wanted to hear what you thought about that, Larry. Whether that there is a bit of a responsibility on people, older people who should know better, around these young riders, not to feed the hype machine.
Well, I don't know. I mean, is also Toby's job to hype up his riders and then get them bigger contracts, right? So, I mean, the funny thing is, like, so I've known Toby since I was a junior, because he was running hot tubes then as well. And yeah, he's running this team forever. And but the guy likes to talk, you know? So, you know, I don't think...
I mean, don't get me wrong. If I'd have been the journalist there that he was talking to, I'd have been salivating at that quote.
But the thing is, I'm like, why did the entire cycling world listen to a junior team director about his own rider? You know, like, I mean, but I could say something random about some kid.
That is a zinger.
You know?
That is a zinger of a quote.
Sure, but anyway, I just think, like, I mean, the guy just talks, and, you know, I'm sure he just said this off the cuff, like, you know, and didn't really think twice about it. But in the end, he probably did a great job for AJ, because I'm sure he signed a great contract and then everyone wanted this guy. But it's like, what? I mean, this guy doesn't know anything about Remco, you know, and he doesn't know how Remco was at that age. He doesn't know his power, all that stuff. So anyway, I have to say, when I read that at the time, I laughed knowing who Toby was. But, you know, in the end, what I will say about AJ is that he did, as a junior, win like the mountain stage in like the Redlands Cycling Classic, which is sort of like historically one of the biggest like domestic sort of elite races in the US. And, you know, the mountain stage is sort of like, yeah, where all the guys sort of like come out to shine. And to win that as a junior is like pretty legit. So that was like you know, really good ride because he did it with, like, you know, all the elite riders and stuff. So, you know, he obviously showed that he had the talent. But then where I think it kind of went wrong was, like, he moved to Andorra as, like, an 18-year-old alone in an apartment on the bottom of Ordino, like, as in didn't have a car, literally was, like, a couple kilometers from the nearest grocery store, you know, in a town, village of maybe, like, I don't know, 1,000 people. And, I mean, who is letting this kid do that, you know?
The poor kid was thinking, people expect me to be better than Remco. I better get a move on.
Well, yeah, but I mean, okay, then, like, you know, I don't know, go somewhere where there are people, you know? I mean, if you're not going to have a car and, like, maybe, I don't know, it's probably hard to buy a car at 18 in Europe, I would say. It's already hard to buy a car when you're not 18 in Europe and you're not from here, you know? So, you know, I mean, the guy, like, yeah, he'd have to take a bus to go to the grocery store, you know, however far away. And, like, you know, it's like, I mean, I just think they could have set him up in a better scenario. You know, I mean, already when I moved to Europe when I was, like, 22 years old alone, it was so hard for me. And I had, like, a bunch of other friends and, you know, a director and everyone close to me around. But still, I struggled, you know, and I could walk to the grocery store. And, you know, like, I mean, I just think, like, to me, that was the biggest mistake. You know, and I remember speaking to him in some of the races that year, and I think he was just trying to figure out life more than the bike, you know? And so I think that's the problem when these young guys come overseas, you know, to Europe, either from, like, you know, US or Australia, New Zealand, all these places, just trying to figure out life is, like, the hardest thing, you know. The bike is, like, the last of your worries, sort of, you know? So I think one thing that should be taken more into account for these young guys if they're coming, you know, from far from home. You know, the great thing about, like, so many of the Europeans, if they go pro at 18, they're living in their parents' house, you know? I mean, I knew a guy who I used to be teammates with, and, like, he was making, you know, I think over $1 million living in his parents' house. You know, I mean, like, that I can't say, but, like, you know, this is, like, a European young rider, and so, yeah, obviously life is easy if your mom's still cooking for you and doing your laundry when you go home. But, you know, at 18, like, I don't know. I mean, I had to learn to do my own laundry and learn to cook and all these things. Not to mention figure out, like, everything else about life. So to me, I think teams really need to take that more into account and, you know, sort of provide a way better support system for these young guys, especially if they're going to bring them over to Europe.
Well, Larry, it's good to see that he seems to be thriving. Anyway, there were three riders. I mentioned Michael Leonard. There were three riders I've sort of watched over the last couple of years and feared that they might have sort of lost themselves a little bit because they turned professional so early, too early probably. Michael Leonard, AJ August, and Markel Melocchi was the other one.
Okay, yeah, just one other thing about Michael Leonard, though. The difference is, from what I read, is that he actually just only turned pro solely off of his power numbers. So that's, like, a totally different ball game, I think, because then you don't really know what the guy does in a race situation. So anyway, I think AJ, he won, like, every junior race there was to win. So slightly different scenarios there. Oh, and just to keep going, sorry. But, like, I also think that this is something that happened to Ineos for, like, the last few years, is they were so scared to lose all these talents. They signed all these guys way too prematurely, and then they weren't able to race. You know, like, this guy who broke the Colderates record, this was his name, Peter Oxenberg or something. I mean, he's hardly raced. Then they signed this other guy, Theodore Storm or whatever, which I don't know if he ended up racing with him.
Yeah, I mean, another Oxenberg was another guy. I mean, I know his director sportif at Colo Quick, or his former director sportif at Colo Quick very well, Christian Moberg, and I spoke to Christian about him, and he talked to me about how inexperienced he was just as a cyclist. Very, very inexperienced. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think now they're realizing that maybe that was not the best strategy, and making a change. But it is really nice to see AJ coming around now and finding his legs, because he's also a really nice kid, and I think he has a good head on his shoulder. So Hopefully it's the beginning of a lot more to come.
So Larry, that was the stage racing that happened last weekend. Now, since last weekend, other stage races have started. Foremost among them is the second World Tour stage race of the year, isn't it? UAE Tour. Of course, Jonas Vingegaard was supposed to do this. He did not line up because of his crash in training a few weeks ago, but Remco Evenepoel was at the start. Of course, Remco's had a fantastic start to the season with his new team, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. I think he was on 6 wins, was it? 6 or 7? The favourite, possibly, for this race, alongside Isaac Del Toro. And Del Toro struck immediately with this extraordinary stage win on day one at the Liwa Palace. I'd forgotten this, but Tadej Pogacar tried something vaguely similar on this stage. First, I think it was the first stage again last year. It's sort of rising, finishing straight. Pogacar kind of attacked last year, accelerated, and very quickly realised that he wasn't going to get away, he wasn't going to break any kind of elastic, and it ended up looking like a routine sprint stage. This was different. Del Toro, within 3 or 4 sort of pedal revs, he opened up a gap and was able to stay away. And it was really impressive, wasn't it, Larry?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the difference is I think Tadej tried a little bit earlier last year, and then Del Toro went a little bit later this year, but it was super impressive to be able to ride away from all those guys on an uphill finish like that. And he really showed like he's in good shape.
The following day, I actually expected him to go much better in the time trial. Remco Evenepoel was the favourite for that time trial, and he duly justified that billing. He beat Josh Tarling by 5 seconds. Del Toro was a long way down. Was he 40-something seconds down, I think, if not more. He looked very uncomfortable on the bike. He was shifting a lot in the saddle. And at that point, well, it sort of re-emphasized how well Remco was going. And there was a lot of curiosity then about the following day's stage, yesterday's stage, that was to a new summit finish, Jebel Mobra, which has not been used in the UAE Tour before. I think it's a new road, actually.
I think it's a new road, yeah.
And on paper, at least, this is a climb that bears comparison with the very hardest the pro races have ever done, really. World Tour races have ever done. The likes of the Angliru, the Zoncolan. So last 6 kilometres, average gradient of 11.73%. The hardest 6 kilometres of the Zoncolan are 15% average. The hardest 6 kilometres of the Angliru are 13.5% average. So not quite as hard, but certainly in the
category. Hard enough.
In the sort of category of the kind of Uber climbs. And Larry, you could kind of see there was a certain caginess, I suppose, in the bunch. I mean, also they couldn't go a whole lot faster, but I suspect there was a little bit of caginess. Most of the riders in the peloton, almost all the riders, hadn't done this before, and until about 6 kilometers to go, not too much had happened. The group was still pretty big. It was only around at that point that we saw the likes of Tarling getting dropped, but then we saw Del Toro quite a long way back. Well, a very long way back. I don't know whether it's 30th wheel or something like that in the main group, and indeed he started getting dropped. Felix Gau was accelerating at the front of the bunch, and initially Remco Evenepoel tried to go with him, and he was the only rider initially who did go with Felix Gau. Then the situation changed fairly quickly. We saw something that we've seen now, it seems like, fairly regularly, certainly in the Grand Tours with Remco, certainly saw in the Tour de France last year on the really big climbs, started losing ground. And you wondered at that point whether there'd been a bit of sort of hubris. We'd seen him at the end of last year, particularly there were a number of times where he tried to follow Tadej Pogacar on climbs and get distance. And it looked as though he'd sort of had eyes too big for his plate. He'd kind of overestimated himself. And that ended up, well, certainly he ended up suffering yesterday and lost 2 minutes to Isaac Del Toro, around about 2 minutes. Because Isaac Del Toro did an incredible sort of Almeida-esque remontada. We thought he was all at sea, and then he slowly started gaining ground, riding through the field, and eventually He finished second on the stage, second behind, I suppose, a surprise stage winner, but someone who's also been in very good form at the start of this season, Antonio Tiberi, the Italian rider. And that sets up a showdown on Jebel Hafit on Sunday. I'm just going to bring up time gaps now.
Saturday, I think. No.
I think it's Sunday. I thought it was Saturday. What's today, Larry? Okay. Thursday. I think it's Sunday.
Yeah.
It's Sunday, and we'll confirm that for you before the end of the part. And he's 21 seconds down, Larry, on general classification. And, well, the next best rider is Harold Tejada of XDS Astana. So it should be a head-to-head battle between Del Toro, of course. It's his team UAE's home race versus Tiberi. But, Larry, what did you make of that yesterday?
Yeah, so I thought it was interesting. Okay, I definitely expected Del Toro to win and just smash everyone on the climb. But I think he messed up a little bit. I think, you know, the thing is, when you're on like a really steep climb like that, the best thing to do is to totally pace yourself, you know? But I think he probably paced himself almost a little too much at the start, in that, like, you know, a lot of times when you hit these climbs, there's so many guys whose like job it is to, like, you know, take their guy into the bottom of the climb. They get super excited and then they just go full for like the first minute or two, you know? I mean, even, you know, I've done it before, you know, it's just like, you like, okay, I got my leader on my wheel, you know, we're in the bottom. Okay. Like, let's go full, you know? But the thing is, on a 12% climb, that's like the worst thing you can do. You know, it's better to just like, just sit there and ride your pace. Now, the problem is, I think by riding his pace, you know, I think he was trying to probably be conservative at the bottom and be like, okay, I want to save it, you know, for the last hard part. I'm going to stay in the wheels, try to stay in the draft. And then, you know, I'll just do my pace when we get to like this steep part with like six, seven K to go. And he ends up, I think, you know, maybe he doesn't follow that initial acceleration at the bottom. So, you know, maybe they're doing 500 watts and he says, I'm going to stick on 400 or something. And the problem is, then everyone follows the people in front and then they all explode. And then he just has to like essentially weave through guys the whole time. So I think what he should have done is just stayed at the front. He was strong enough, you know, to stay at least in the first 20. You said 30, but I think he was like more like 50th wheel. He was really at the back of the bunch. Then it strings out and then it starts splitting and he has to just close every single gap. And he did like ridiculous power. I saw like, I think Velon published, he did something like 470 watts for the last 9 minutes. And he's like 64 kilos or something. So that is like ungodly power. But I'm sure if he would have just stayed in the wheels, you know, of like the guys at the front, he wouldn't have had to do that crazy of power and he probably would have won the stage. So I think it was a mistake. I think he was trying to be smart and he ended up getting a little bit caught out. But I mean, it happens and, you know, you learn from things like that. And I'm sure he's still going to probably win the overall, I would guess.
Larry, how much of this is a sort of style choice? I mean, I cited the example, the comparison with Almeida. With him, there's a very clear, it's a pretty sort of transparent physiological limitation, if you can call it that, that this is, so he climbs it almost in this fashion because that's what his body seems to, all that his body seems to allow him to do. I say all, I mean, he's one of the best climbers in the world. But with Del Toro, it has been a characteristic of his riding as well ever since he came into the World Tour. I remember Tirreno Adriatico a couple of years ago in his first year and we saw the same thing there. And we've seen the same thing in most races since.
I mean, I think it's a choice. You know, I think these guys...
Not with Almeida. Like, okay, not with Almeida. Do you think?
I mean, I think it's a choice with Almeida. Okay, in the end, sometimes with Almeida, he's not the best on the descent, so he ends up at the back and then has to like climb back up, or he doesn't like to fight, things like that. But I think with Almeida, it's still a choice. I mean, this guy is one of the best five climbers in the world. So don't tell me that like he can't follow the first 30 guys at the bottom of the climb. You know, like, I mean, easily he could if he chose to, you know, but he thinks like, okay, I don't want to go over my limit. I'm going to keep my pace. Yeah. I'm going to be smart about it. And I'm going to pick guys off one by one, you know?
But do you not think that his limit is such that he knows the consequences for going over it are more serious, more damaging than they are for other riders?
I don't think they're more damaging. I think he just thinks about it more than other riders do, you know? You know, I think there's some guys who are like, okay, you know, they're a bit more intellectual about it, and then other guys who are just like, I'm just going to follow the wheel in front of me, and I need to be at the front, and then, you know, like, I just go, right? Whereas, like, other guys are like, I better, like, you know, do this perfectly, and then, but then the problem is, I mean, even me personally, if I'm in the bunch sometimes, you know, going into the climb, I like to be smart, and then, but in the end, sometimes you try to be smart and you try to save energy, and it ends up costing you energy in the end, because then splits happen and you're like, oh damn, you know, I need to make up for this difference. So honestly, while it does work well sometimes, and it should work on a climb like this one in UAE, that's like 12%. I think when you're as strong as Del Toro is, you can't take that risk. You know, I think if you're maybe a second tier, climber, then maybe you should take that risk, because if it pays off, it pays off bigger. Whereas like Del Toro is still going to beat everyone if he does the same, you know, if he does the bottom at the same pace as everyone else, he's going to be stronger than them at the top. So to me, it's just like he made a mistake, you know?
I think it's going to be hard for him on Jebel Hafid. Do you not, would you not agree?
No. I think he's so strong. I think he's going to win. Yeah.
Okay. Because that.
I don't know. I mean, Tiberi is obviously going well, but I still think like Tiberi is a little bit bigger, and you know, I think Jebel Hafid is maybe like slightly more explosive because it's a little bit shorter, and I just think it's probably going to suit Del Toro better. But you never know. Never know. I mean, for sure, like, Tiberi could still win. But
Jebel Hafid, which is on Saturday, you're right, Larry. It's the penultimate stage. Larry.
I listened when they were talking about this on the broadcast.
I just couldn't. I just lost track of the days. Larry, talking about Del Toro's style, particularly on that climb, that's sort of the perfect runway to talk about Remco as well, because when I described what happened, I talked about maybe the kind of hubris, maybe that Remco has fallen victim to over the last couple of years on various occasions, that he tends to back himself, or he wants to back himself. And he's obviously interviewed a lot more than most riders, so we hear a lot more from him, and he's also, as we've said many times, he's a good communicator. He seems to like talking about what he's going to do. So there've been various statements about his ambitions at this race, and in the position that he's in, obviously big signing for Red Bull, he kind of has to back himself. He has to back himself in words, and he also has to back himself in kind of deeds, and that means that he knew yesterday he was expected to follow the best riders. So when the first big attack goes, Felix Gal, he does try and follow. And then he seems to pay for that later. Is that how you see it? And what's your assessment generally of this kind of project, I suppose, of Remco's to make up his deficiencies or remedy his deficiencies as a climber and ultimately be the guy who's going to challenge Pogacar?
I mean, he should back himself, you know. I think that's the right thing to do, because he is one of the best riders in the world, you know. I mean, yeah, he's probably one of the three best riders in the world. And, you know, I think maybe just it's possible that at, like, right now, at this point in the season, maybe his climbing form isn't at his best, you know. And then, you know, maybe it was hot yesterday. Maybe, like, the heat could have had an effect if he hasn't been doing, like, a whole ton of heat preparation, things like that. But, you know, I mean, he's shown that he is probably one of the three best riders in the world. So why would you not back yourself, I guess, you know? And I mean, the only thing that he probably didn't need to do was follow Felix at the bottom of the climb if Felix went really hard, which I obviously think he did because he also blew. But, you know, I think he could have probably waited a little bit, but I also don't know if he had any teammates left. Because I think that was one thing that, like, surprised me, is it didn't appear like he had very many teammates on that climb in the final. So maybe then you think, like, okay, if I'm isolated, I better do it myself. So I think that could have been also what happened.
Larry, we talked about physiology a while ago with Pogacar. Remco's 63 kilos, and we all know, well, we've seen the power that he can put out in the time trial, whether it's a 20-minute time trial, a 40-minute time trial, a one-hour time trial. So in very basic terms, explain to the layman why he can't climb as well as Pogacar if he's lighter than him and he can potentially put out the same power for the same amount of time.
I mean, I would assume he can't put out the same power. Okay. I'm 97% sure he can't do the same power as Pogacar.
Because his aerodynamics are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the time trial, not on the flat.
Yeah, I mean, so he's like ridiculously aero. And he obviously does super high power. I also saw like some of the numbers from Velon of like some of the segments of his time trial, and it was like ridiculous the power he was doing. So, you know, yeah, maybe he's like 1 kilo lighter than Pogacar or something if he's 63 kilos. You know, I think Pogacar is like 64. And then, I mean, I'm sure Pogacar does more power. It's just Remco's way more aero because he's like a lot more compact, you know? And I mean, he is insanely aero both on the TT and road bike. So, you know, I'd say, you know, there's power to weight and then there's power to CDA, and, you know, CDA is coefficient of drag. And I'm sure Remco has the best power to CDA in the world, where, you know, I guess Pogacar definitely have the best power to weight. So, you know, I think he's one of the best climbers, but he's definitely not Pogacar's level. But again, you know, he's probably third best in the world. So also good. He just maybe had an off day, and maybe he isn't in his best climbing form at the moment.
There must be, as a complete physiology layman, there are subtle differences as well in people's engines, aren't there? We talked there about Almeida, about how maybe a different thing happens to one rider when they go over their, in inverted commas, limit, and it might be a sort of psychological limit or a real physiological limit. Different riders react in different ways, don't they? I mean, that feels like that's part of the puzzle as well with Pogacar as opposed to Remco. It's not as simple as just power, you know, a 30-minute power test on an indoor rig. Compare Remco, Pogacar, the difference in that will not explain everything we see on the road.
100%. And then the other thing that like is very different about UAE Tour is it's usually one climb, whereas like so many of these other races, there's six climbs, you know, like or whatever, you know, I mean, there'll be 3,000 meters of climbing, and then the last climb is 20 minutes after you did 4 or 5 coals already, you know. And that is so different than just going on a dead flat race in the wheels, you know, hardly pedaling, and then boof, you do one effort, full gas. So, you know, that's also another thing is like some riders are better at these one-off efforts than others. And some riders struggle on the, you know, we call it like with the durability, which is like being able to do the power at the end of a long, hard stage. So, you know, I'm 100% sure that if Remco has been training, you know, to improve in the Grand Tours, he's not training to be the best at a one-off effort. He's training to be the best after 6 hours or 5 hours of racing or whatever. So, you know, that could also play a part. But, yeah.
And just before we conclude this part on Remco, Larry, we didn't have you. We haven't had you here the last couple of weeks to answer this question, but we've speculated about Remco's suitability for Milan-San Remo. And I have said that, okay, despite people's misgivings about positioning, that's something you can probably learn over the course of a couple of editions of Milan-San Remo, even if it doesn't necessarily come naturally to you. With him, and with someone who's attempting to win the race, we know how important being in the right position, for example, on the bottom of the Cipressa is now. You've done Milan-San Remo many, many times. Would you agree with that he, well, A, he's a rider who could do very well in Milan-San Remo, and B, if he does have issues with positioning in Milan-San Remo, maybe the first time, then the second or third time, he can probably rectify those.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't even think he'd have issues with positioning. I mean, I think in the end with him, okay, one, he has a super good team, so I'm sure they'd put him in the right place. And even if not, if you just say, follow Pogacar, everyone is going to let Remco in. You know what I mean? Like Remco, if he wants to be on Pogacar's wheel, he can be on Pogacar's wheel because no one's going to like try to push him off of it. And so I don't think position would be a problem. And then, yeah, definitely, I think he has the racing style, you know, and ability to win that race because he's super punchy. You know, if you look at like the Olympic road race, for example, the way he won that race would be the way you would win San Remo. So yeah, I don't see why not.
Last stage race to mention, it was two stages, stage races to mention are stage races that are ongoing, and that is the Volta Algarve, which began yesterday with stage win for Paul Meunier, the Sudal Quickstep sprinter. Now, the key dates, Larry, if I can get the days of the week right this time, key dates there are Alto de Foya, that's first mountaintop finish, hilltop finish, very familiar from that race, from previous editions of that race. So that's Thursday. TT on Friday, and we've got Alto do Malau on Sunday. So that should be interesting. We've got Sexas in action there as well. Larry's smiling. And we've also got this week the Ruta del Sol, the Tour of Andalucía in the south of Spain. First stage of that yesterday was won by Christophe Laporte. And that is an intriguing but slightly inscrutable route this year. Not much in the way of climbing. A lot of stages that look as though they might suit sort of punchy, sprinty type riders. But we shall see. We shall see.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is sponsored by Saily, brought to you by our friends at NordVPN. It's an app which can help you to reduce or even eliminate expensive roaming charges when you're using your mobile phone abroad. And as you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get 15% off your first purchase when you download the Saily app in your app store using the discount code cycling, or by going to saily.com/cycling. Now, when you're traveling abroad, you want to use your mobile phone as if you were at home, making calls and sending messages, taking pictures to post on Instagram so that people can see all of the lovely sights that you're seeing, or even downloading and listening to podcasts when you're on the move or relaxing by the pool. And doing all of that can mean that your data roaming charges rack up. Saily can help you to reduce those costs. It's very convenient. You don't need to buy a SIM card at the airport like you used to have to do back in the day. Instead, it's just an eSIM, which is an app that you download once, and then you buy the plan which covers the countries that you're traveling to. There's now the Saily Ultra plan as well, which is a real bumper package of benefits. Too many to list here, but you can check it out at saily.com. There's a built-in VPN to protect your privacy, a built-in ad blocker as well, which means that when you're browsing the internet, you're reducing your data usage by up to 28%. And there's 24/7 support as well, and a full refund if you find that your device isn't eSIM compatible. So go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling, and keep connected when you're on the move.
Well, Larry, we have dealt with the stage races that we have seen and that we will see over the next few days. There's also some significant one-day racing that's taken place over the last few days. The Figueira Champions Classic in Portugal, won by a Portuguese rider, local boy, Antonio Morgado of UAE, ahead of Alex Aramburu. And we also had the GP Almeria in the south of Spain, again in Andalucía, and that was won by Scarbu Gamay of NSN. Was it Never Say Never? No, is it Never Say? Yes, yeah, Never Say Never, isn't it? NSN. Anyway, it's the new team. The Catalan team, I suppose we should say.
And Scarbu Gamay won it.
No, sorry, did I say Scarbu Gamay?
Yeah.
Sorry, Biniam Gamay. That's because I was talking to...
yeah, apologies. Yeah, makes more sense now. Okay.
I was talking to Scarbu Gamay this morning, hence why.
Okay,
he didn't win it. He's now retired, right?
Yeah, I thought so, but keep going.
Yes. No, it was won by Biniam Gamay. His second win of the season for his new NSN team. And on just a short distance from Almeria, the other side of Andalucía, on Monday, we had the Jaén Paraíso Interior race, a gravel race between the sort of winds through the olive groves of that beautiful part of the world, Jaén. That was won by Tim Wellens, who has gone well in that race in the past, and it was pretty impressive effort. He attacked with about 54 kilometers to go, or soloed from about 54 kilometers to go, and was never really threatened. Bit of controversy, bit of beef behind Larry, because in the sprint for the minor places, Tim Wellens' teammate Jan Christen, who's becoming a bit of a controversial figure. Well, he deviated and cut across Maxime Van Hills, the Red Bull Borat Hansgrohe rider who crashed, then sat up, seemed to be okay, but we have subsequently learned that he suffered some pretty serious injuries, including a broken pelvis, and he's going to be out for months.
You know, I think he also broke his shoulder. Months. They found out today.
Broke his shoulder, yes. Yeah. Kristen was relegated. His third place was inherited by his teammate, Benoit Cosnefroy, who, of course, moved to UAE this year. That was one controversial incident. There was another controversial incident in Almeria when I mentioned not Nskabu Gamai, but Biniam Gamai won there. He's very impressive, I must say, NSN lead out train. Dropped him off very well in Almeria. But one member of that train, Lewis Askey, he continued sprinting, not as fast as the people were sprinting either side of him. But he continued sprinting kind of down the middle of the road or down the middle of the group. And this forced riders such as Arnaud Delis to take evasive action. And it looked pretty gnarly. They all managed to stay on their bikes, but it looked pretty dangerous. And this led to calls. I didn't see any riders necessarily express their outrage, Larry, but I certainly saw a lot of people on social media suggest Askey should be sanctioned. We know that this is an aspect of sprint finishes that's come under the microscope the last couple of years. Of course, in the UCI regulations, Article 2.3.036, riders shall be strictly forbidden to deviate from the lane they selected when launching into the sprint, and in doing so, endangering others. And the sort of pro etiquette, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lead out rider is expected to keep pedaling, which Askey did. And well, what should they do, Larry? What should a lead out rider do ideally?
I think they should get out of the way more than try to go down the middle. You know, I think that was sort of like the thing that the error that he made was he was just like, oh, I'm going to keep going straight down the middle. And he hardly even swung off, you know? And so then that essentially caused chaos behind because he was going back slower than everyone else. But it would have been better if he just swung all the way to the left side of the road and then sat up.
Yeah, I've heard the suggestion that he was possibly sprinting to try and pick up a few points. Well, carried on sprinting.
I mean, to be honest, it looked like he was just trying to get in the way. But yeah, I don't know. Exactly.
Larry, how easy is that to just swing off?
Easier than trying to keep going, that's for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so as far as you're concerned, no real excuses.
No.
And the other incident I mentioned, Jan Christen versus Maxime Van Hills, that was pretty, to be honest,
I think it was a mistake. You know, I don't think he meant to.
No, of course.
Yeah. But I mean, people were going on like it was like he meant to do this and blah, 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 whatever. And, you know, I think like Christen is a controversial rider, but I think he for other reasons, you know what I mean? Like maybe not being a great teammate, things like that, like attacking at dumb times. But like he also rides kind of erratically, you know, and I don't think he meant to do that. And I don't think he should take so much heat for it because like it was a mistake, you know, and he was just trying to follow Pidcock or whatever, you know. And in the end, Maxime Van Hills was overlapping his wheel, which also could be considered an error, you know. So, you know, if Van Hills wasn't overlapping the wheel, you know, he probably wouldn't have crashed. So it's not all Jan Christen's fault. But, yeah, I mean, okay, it's fine to relegate him, I guess. But I don't think, like, he should serve anything more than that.
So that's that cleaned up, Larry. Your teammates, your Tudor teammates, they've been in action in some, not all of these races. How's it going generally, Larry? What's morale like in the team? We mentioned Tom Pidcock a couple of times, Pinarello Q36.5. Are they the big rivals? They're the big Swiss. Is that the big Swiss old firm?
I guess they're rivals because they're also one of the top pro continental teams.
Okay.
But no, you know, I think it's just for us. We want to be I think if we can improve on our ranking from last year, I think we were 13th team last year. If we can keep improving on that, I think that'll be a success. So, you know, it'd be interesting. I think this week we have Alaphilippe and then Kung starting their seasons at Portugal.
Stefan Kung's gone very well before on the Foya climb.
Okay, yeah. So we'll see. I mean, new BMC bike, TT bike that he'll be debuting in the time trial. Well, they raced it like already in UAE and in the team time trial at Mallorca. But, you know, I think that this will be a big, it'll be important for him and for the team because they put a lot of investment in him. So that'll be interesting to see. Hopefully he gets a result and can, pay back the team for all the investment they've done in his position and, you know, equipment and things like that. And then it'll be interesting to see.
That kind of investment, I was wondering whether you were suggesting Stefan Kung's on a really fat salary there.
I mean, I'm sure he's on a good one. That's also an investment. Well. But I meant more like, I know they're like, they've gone all in on his TT position and stuff. And so, you know, it's like they've given him every single, you know, gain that I think exists. So I think it'll be interesting to see.
I was trying to remember why did I mention Q36.5, and it's because the last item we're going to have on podcast today is a chat I had with Fred Wright of Q30. I should call them Pinarello. I only realized the other day that their actual name now is Pinarello Q36.5. But Fred Wright, of course, has joined them this year from Bahrain Victorious, and we're going to play out with my little chat with Fred Wright a couple of days ago. But the main focus of that was something that's intrigued quite a lot of people about how Pinarello Q36.5 have prepared for 2026 season, namely with a training camp in Chile, of all places, in the Andes. Larry, were you surprised when you heard this?
Yeah, I think I was surprised because, like, it's not exactly a common place to go. I was just like, oh, that's interesting. You know, you would have thought if you're going to go to like South America, you'd go to like Colombia or something because there's like all the cycling infrastructure. So I don't totally know how they settled on Chile. I'd say what was the most controversial among cyclists was that they were at like 2,700 meters, you know? And like, you know, I don't know, it's more... In the cycling world, all these people are like, you have to be between 2,000 and 2,200 or 2,300 meters, you know? And if you go like higher or lower, like, don't go. You know what I mean? Like, which to me is just ridiculous. I'd say one of the best altitude camps I did and we did as a team with Decathlon was when we went to Etna, and that was at maybe like 1,900 or something. And I mean, we all felt great after and we had great results. So that seemed to work well. And then, you know, I mean, there's people that go higher than 2,400. So to be honest, I think it's fine as long as you adjust the training and the workload and everything for the altitude you're at. But I think everyone's like, oh, curious to see, because like, imagine they're all flying. Now we're all going to go to like, you know, 3,000 meters next year. So. That was kind of an interesting thing and will be interesting to follow. But it appears that Pidcock's going well, and we'll see about his teammates.
You'll soon all be staying in this tiny but wooden bivouacs. Exactly. It seems to me, Larry, just anecdotally listening to riders over the last couple of years, the one thing that is changing with altitude training is a lot of the guesswork appears to have ceased. In the sense, I often had the impression, even speaking to you over the years, that you didn't always know what you were going to get out of the other side of it. And there was still a certain degree of experimentation. And it seems to me there's a much more solid knowledge about the effects of different altitudes, different training loads at altitude, different recovery periods, and so on and so forth.
I don't know about that. I still think it's totally undecided. Sure. I mean, like... many debates over like, yeah, how high should you go? Should you train high? Should you only train low? You know, I don't know. There's like a million different things.
Larry, I thought of you the other day because I don't know if this is a recent academic paper, but it certainly got some airplay in the last few days. a paper suggesting that ice baths, cryotherapy, is now a bad idea because it reduces inflammation, and inflammation is actually what you want after training. And after,
This is old news, Daniel. Yeah.
I'm off the. So have they been discarded by?
No, because I mean the thing is for example, in a race like the Vuelta, you know, like a hot race.
You sounded so disappointed in me.
I was curious. But no, I mean, you know, the thing is like, yeah, it's okay to like keep the inflammation down during a race. So, you know, you still want to do an ice bath maybe in the Vuelta. You know, you bring your core temp down and, you know, it's okay to stop that inflammation because you don't necessarily want this adaptation or the stress. You want to, the stress is so high, you probably want to minimize the stress anyway in a grand tour, things like that. But in training, yeah, you don't want to do ice baths because, like, you know, it can blunt the adaptations because you want that stress. That's why you're training, you know. So, yeah, ice bath bad, you know, like too much vitamin C bad, things like that. Anything that could blunt your adaptation, you know, anything that could blunt the stress can negatively affect your adaptations after.
Well, the good news is, Larry, I live in a state of constant stress and inflammation, so I think I'm on the right track.
Yeah,
and Larry,
yeah.
We're going to play out with Fred Wright, and we will catch up with you soon in the next few weeks. Best of luck with the racing of the weekend in your backyard, effectively. I don't know, does the race go past your front door?
No, but it goes just up the hill, so yeah, it goes like maybe a K or two from my house, so.
Very nice. And yeah, after that, as we heard earlier, you've got Tirreno and various other things, so we will catch up with you in a few weeks, but thank you in the meantime, and we, as I said, are going to play out with Fred Wright, and we'll be back next week. Omloop preview, Lionel will be back, I think Rob Hatch will probably be with us, so until then, goodbye.
Ciao, ciao.
So before I ask you about Chile specifically, just tell me, if you had to sum up, you obviously have changed teams. I mean, could you have stayed at Bahrain, and why did you want to change teams if you did, and why did you choose this team?
I got a sort of, yeah, thank Bahrain for it was a great, like, 6 years that I had, but 6 years is also a long time, and I think at one point you kind of get you get into that, the trap of repeating the same things over and over again. And you know, I'm someone, you know, I'm fascinated in the sport by the process of trying to get better. And it's an everlasting process. So to be, you know, to change environments and be in a team who were looking for those extra levels of improvement, I think I really needed that. And I'm really happy with, you know, where I found myself, because, yeah, they're definitely looking in the right places in terms of trying to maximize performance.
Okay, so when you heard the team was going up to Chile on a training camp, how soon did you know that? I mean, Kurt's been quoted as saying, well, it was optional. What did you think when that idea was presented to you?
It was something I'd already thought about, but in the past, like, I was always wanted to know if altitude pre-classics would work. So for me, it was almost as like an experiment for myself. Like, I may have told my girlfriend that it was less optional than maybe Kerr has described. Like, yeah, three and a half weeks away in Chile, so I've got to do it. But no, it was, I really wanted to know. She gets it. I really wanted to see if that's the right thing for me, if it works. Because I was feeling pretty good on Sunday, so I'm excited to see how these first races go.
Talk to me about the first impressions. I mean, it's close to Santiago where you went. It's the one road, isn't it? It's the road, I guess, you rode every day.
Yeah. There was a lot of time spent groveling up a long climb, which, yeah, maybe, I think from a physiological standpoint, it's great. It's great to, you know, improve in the heat and the altitude. It's gonna make you physiologically better, whether it's, I've definitely had to, you know, the last couple of weeks try and adjust a little bit to get back into racing, you know, because it's not, there was a lot of slogging going on, and the race is getting faster these days. You're not crawling up climbs. So, there weren't so many road options, but I think if you look at the kind of the actual stimuli of what was there, it's, it's kind of easy. It's easy to train sometimes when all you've got to do is ride your bike, and that's hard enough, you know. That's the first few days was a bit like, oh, this is gonna be tough, because you know the first few days are still adapting to the altitude, and obviously even higher than
I was gonna ask
I've stayed
you.
Before, so yeah. It took a bit longer to adapt. But actually, you know, come the last week, it was nice. And it's amazing, Chile. I didn't quite realize how big the cycling community was there. That took me by surprise. Some of the weekends coming down the climb, the amount of people coming up, it was like quite similar to Alderates and Calpe, you know, like just masses and masses of cyclists. So that was nice to see be quite well received in Chile. You know, like it wasn't like it would. Sort of drivers like, oh, what, you know, what are these cyclists doing here? It seems quite a cycling friendly place as well. It was one of the hardest training camps I've done. I think I would say that, but I think I tend to always go well after resting post Grand Tour. So by that logic, 3 weeks of suffering in Chile should also be beneficial. I think that's, to put it simply, I think it should be good. You know, the nutrition focus on this team is great. So actually, it was quite clear to me almost straight away that previous altitude camps I'd done, I probably wasn't eating enough. You know, to accommodate for the fact that you're burning a bit more being so high. First few days, it was quite a shock. And I think that, you know, the whole team were a bit, no one was really sure how it was going to go. But then, yeah, we all seemed to respond quite well. I think if I, you know, to do it again, maybe I'd try and get myself a bit more heat adapted, because I normally struggle in the heat. And there was some of the days when with the climb, we were doing efforts was sort of 35 plus, you know, like 40 degrees on the Garmin. It's a couple of days I do my efforts, feel fine. And then, you still have to climb 30K back home, and
yeah,
and it really hits you. So a few days like that. But like I said, come the last week and a bit, we were all good.
Anything in the way of kind of cultural immersion? I mean, I know that place is was famous for the condors. You're about 60 kilometers, I think, from Aconcagua, like the highest mountain in the Andes. But did you get to see much? Or
I have to say, the condors were pretty spectacular. I've got a lot of videos on my phone of condors. In terms of seeing other things, no, we had a nice time. We went down in the city and one of the days and explored a little bit. It's a really cool place. It just kind of blew me away. Actually, I'd love to go back or see Chile. See that, you know, it's first time in South America for me. So to sort of see. I'd love to see that part of the world, maybe not as a cyclist. I think that's kind of the general rule. You go to these places and you go, yeah, I'll put this on the list for a holiday in the future, maybe.
Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burnett.